Coming up next, it's hour number two of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Why do we never get an answer?
Hey, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yes, in this hour, we are presenting a dear friend and...
He's future, a fellow futurist, he's for
fellow
sure.
Futurist, for sure, yeah. John Ferber is CEO and founder of Legendary Pharmaceuticals. He's an entrepreneur, a scientist, a science journalist, a renaissance scientist, I'd say, who's been studying biology of aging and regeneration for over 20 years. He got his BA in physics and math at University of California at Santa Cruz in 75, I guess one of the earlier graduates of the school, and has a Master of Science degree in biological sciences from University of California at Irvine. In between degrees, he's worked with the United States Congress as a technology policy analyst. And he is on the show right now. Well, welcome, John, to the show.
Hello. Do you hear me?
We hear you. Do you hear us?
Great.
It's a pleasure to be on back in Santa Cruz virtually.
Yes, good, good. Glad to have you. When we asked you to be on the show, you had suggested some reading links that are covering quite an interesting range of topics, all of which we do cover on the show, John. So maybe if we could go into each of these areas a little bit, you can tell us what is really exciting with them. The first that you had mentioned was the asteroid and comet impact threat. And from what I could see, you've put together all the different ways in which asteroids and comets might actually impact the Earth and ways of dealing with them.
Yeah, give us a little bit of background, John. How come you're so fascinated with impact events and how come you're so knowledgeable about it? And then which ones would you recommend?
Okay, well, like buying fire insurance for your house, you want to be prepared in case something very rarely but catastrophically happens. And things do slam into the Earth, sometimes small things and sometimes large things. And every now and then a very large thing slams into the Earth. And we now have the technology that if we look carefully out there for it, we can divert it in time. But if we aren't looking, it could show up in our telescopes a week before, and we wouldn't have time to react.
So what is the current status of looking for such potentially dangerous asteroids?
Well, there is some work going on that's funded by the U.S. government, the Russian Federation government, the Chinese government, the European Union. They are funding some telescope scanning of the skies, and this is all good. There is a private foundation, the B612 Foundation, that is making plans to launch a satellite that would track the Earth's orbit, but from inside the Earth's orbit so that it's always looking out away from the sun. Hmm. When we're on Earth trying to look for stuff, sometimes what we're looking for would be obscured by the sun. So this is a good start. Another good position for observing might be on the dark side of the moon. The more eyes we have looking for these things, which are often very hard to see because they're covered with carbon and they don't reflect very much sunlight. So,
yes, looking for charcoal in the outer space, right?
Yes, so it helps if we have different telescopes tuned to radar frequencies and infrared frequencies and telescopes located at different positions relative to the Earth so that they can always be looking away from the sun and have the best chance of seeing any potential intruders illuminated. Mm. We need to get several observations in order to plot a path. If you just see a comet once, you don't know where it's going.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how big a threat is this to us, do you think? Is it one chance in 1,000 in the next 50 years or what? Do we even know?
We don't know precisely because the biggest threats are the unexpected ones. There's quite a fair amount of data now gathered about the near-Earth asteroids, which are orbiting a similar orbit to the planet Earth. but there's always the chance that a comet could be coming in from any direction over the whole celestial sphere, not just in the plane of the other planets. So we really need to be looking out for these things.
Hmm. Are there any, John, that you think we have to have an eye on right now? Are you aware of any that have been identified as possible real threats?
No, the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory actually has a list of the most threatening objects, and so far everything on their list looks like it's going to miss us. Now, of course, there's always the possibility that with the chaos of orbital dynamics, that something that doesn't look like it's going to hit us in 30 years might get perturbed in the next 25 years, so that then we have to take precautions.
Yeah, it seems like the solar winds are so unpredictable. They could put some energy out into space that would change all our predictions, right? Something like
that's
that.
That's right. So we need to keep an eye on the ones we know about and keep looking for the ones that we don't know about. And we also need to make preparations to launch a diversion ship. One way of doing that, of course, is to send up a rocket that either would push on the thing with its rocket thrust, or might even set off a nuclear charge, not inside the thing, which would blow it into a pile of gravel. It might still hit us. But
I guess that would be the last-minute solution, huh?
Well, even with that, it's not the last-minute solution. What you want is a standoff blast that will provide some pressure on one side of the object so that it changes its orbit enough to miss us.
Sure, thinking of rockets as thrusters for asteroids, right?
Yeah, either rockets or nuclear blasts seem to be favored by the Lawrence Livermore lab.
They would love nuclear. It looks like there's quite a few nuclear choices here. Very interesting. Hey, well, let's talk about more of this after the break. We also have some callers on the line. Is that what you're saying, Mr. Future?
Yeah. All right.
And we've struck a nerve here, John, so stand by. We'll be right with you.
All right, folks. You're listening to the Dr. Future Show with our guest, John Ferber, futurist. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to John Ferber about asteroid and comet impact threats. We had a caller, Ms. Future?
Yes. We have one of our favorite fan folk fair peers on the frontier here, Billy Sunshine. How are you?
Hi, kids.
Hey.
Hi, Billy.
Hi, guys. So I think we're going to get hit in 2018, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
5 or 10 years ago, I read a little thing in the newspaper on page 2 that said these couple of guys in New Zealand or somewhere had found something they said was possibly going to hit us in 2018. And then a couple of days later, they retracted it and said, oh, no, we were mistaken. And it felt to me like the kind of thing where, you know, it's actually going to hit us, but they don't want us to know. The government said, no, let's kill that because we don't want panic for the next 10 years.
Well, you bring up an interesting episode. Is it possible that there are cover-ups in this arena? What do you think, John?
I think not. And the reason is that anybody can get a telescope, even an amateur. Every country on Earth has professional astronomers, academic astronomers, and any academic who could prove that something is happening would get a fantastic paper in Nature or Science. So this is not the sort of thing that can be covered up.
Yeah.
How many people can actually do the math so that they could know that something is coming, you know, 5 or 10 years later, really? I would assume that's a limited number.
Any advanced amateur and any professional astronomer can do it, and there are computer programs for those that are having trouble doing the math in their heads. But, yeah, the longer an object has been observed, the better you can project its path, and it's very likely that if something is observed and 2 days later they are able to project its path better, then it makes sense that they would retract because they're good scientists.
And there are
whole organizations. Well, you put my mind partly at ease.
Yeah, all right.
Great. Thanks, Bill.
Good.
Thanks, guys.
All right, you bet. Good. Yeah, people do wonder whether or not that information would be covered up. That's good to know that if it's a distributed intelligence here, basically, with lots of people looking for asteroids and comets. Thank you for elucidating that, John. Could you tell us what the deflection proposals are so far for this?
Well, as I mentioned, and there's a little bit more data on my website at legendarypharma.com, the deflection, if you send a rocket up there, you can push on the thing. And if it's far enough in advance, you don't have to push very much because it accelerates with time and It only has to change its orbit by about 6 hours to completely miss the Earth, because that's how long it takes for the Earth's diameter to go that far in its orbit. Hmm. So it doesn't require a big change if you can spot it, say, a year or two out. Mm-hmm. If you spot it a couple of weeks out, it's going to be very difficult to do anything except evacuate the target spot.
And that's where you bring in the nukes. Huh?
You really want the nukes a year out.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't want the nukes turning the single asteroid into a million smithereens
kind of
that
what
are all
the
coming in.
Chinese did to their satellite by blowing one up. It caused a major problem. Yeah.
You just can't divert it enough in a week or two. You really need to spot it early. That's why early detection is so important. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've got, say, 20 or 30 years, it's even easier. But if you have at least a year, you should be able to do it. There's also some proposals of being modeled for using laser beams to shine on an incoming asteroid and a great part of its surface and turn it into its own rocket, which would give it enough thrust over a period of time to divert its orbit enough to miss us.
So what are we talking about? We're talking about using a laser beam to ignite?
No, to push.
Oh, just to push it with the beam.
Yeah. You've got this frozen comet, say, and it's mostly methane ice and water ice, and you shine a laser on it from the Earth or a moon base or an L5 base or one of those, and it evaporates a spot on the surface of the incoming comet. And by evaporating it, it turns it into a sort of a jet that pushes the comet in the opposite direction.
Hmm, that's really interesting. It sort of brings to mind the idea of using a magnifying glass to light a match.
Yeah. Now, one of the advantages of this is that you don't have to wait 6 months for the rocket to get out there to push on the thing. Because if the thing's out, say, the orbit of Mars or something like that, when you spot it, mm-hmm. you'd like to start pushing on it right away. And if we sent a rocket ship up from Earth, it would take months to get out there to a place where it could be pushed on.
Wow, so we could actually heat an asteroid, a spot on an asteroid, enough with a laser to
push it.
To push it? That's pretty amazing that we could
go that far.
Yeah. It would take a big laser, and there's continuing a computer modeling of this scenario, but it looks like under certain circumstances you could do it.
Yeah. Last week we had Bruce Damer on, who talked about Project Shepard, which involved putting like a bag around a comet and stopping it from rotating and then using ion propulsion to move it.
That could certainly be done if you have enough time and a big enough bag.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that and that there was to capture them for study rather than for emergencies like we're talking about here.
Yeah, I'm curious, what size range are we talking about here in terms of when are they big enough to be a threat and how big did they have to be for us to see them?
Well, something the size of a semi-truck blew up over Moscow a couple of years ago and blew out windows, and people who were looking at it got cut with the glass. Something the size of about 5 miles across landed in the Yucatan Peninsula 64 million years ago and created enough of ejecta that was glowing to set all the forests in the world on fire, and then a cloud that lasted long enough to freeze the Earth. And this pretty much wiped out the dinosaurs except for the birds we see today.
Wow. And that was just a few miles across.
And 150 feet would wipe out a city.
Remember, these things are coming in at between 30,000 and 60,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you also mentioned that one hitting the ocean would cause tsunamis as well, which ties in with one of your other areas of interest, tsunami prevention.
Yeah, there are several ways tsunamis are generated, of course.
Yeah.
And we're all familiar with the Japanese tsunami that...
Fukushima. Yeah.
And that was an undersea earthquake. Now, if you have a big rock coming in really fast, it can generate a huge wave as well. But there's another cause of tsunamis that hasn't received as much attention, but it has been studied by a professor of geology at UC Santa Cruz named Stephen Ward. This is an island in the Canary Island chain off the coast of Africa. It's sort of in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and it's a volcanic island. And as time goes by, it pushes up because of the magma below. And about every 10,000 years, it's pushed up so high that the side of the caldera falls over into the ocean and makes a tsunami several hundred feet tall when it reaches the eastern seaboard of the United States.
That's a lot bigger than Fukushima.
It is a lot bigger than Fukushima. Stephen Ward, the professor of geology at UC Santa Cruz, has done some computer modeling of this system. And interestingly enough, it's been about 10,000 years since the last time it happened, and it tends to happen every 10,000 years. It occurs to me that maybe we could do something with demolition equipment to take this unstable piece of rock and caldera apart piece by piece before it all falls over at once.
You mean take apart the mountain before it falls into the ocean?
You want to do a controlled demolition of the caldera?
I think we could do it with earth-moving equipment, strip mining equipment, small charges that would knock it down without catastrophically knocking it over.
Yeah, I guess the cautionary tale there is that you might accidentally trigger it.
Yeah, and what if the caldera was alive and got pissed off and, you know, decided to go off?
Well, the magma is far enough down that it's not in danger of erupting like a volcano.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that it's sort of like a crater with a depression in the center, mm-hmm. and one of the sides is facing the sea, and if that side just slumps into the sea because it's gotten so high and heavy, that creates the big wave.
Yeah, it's sort of like a messy wax candle on a wine bottle or something.
John, how many disasters waiting to happen like that do we have on this planet? Is this common?
That's why I became interested and started looking into it and put up a couple of web pages with some information on it, which you probably have on your website.
I'll link your pages to our links page so that people can take a look at that.
You know, it occurs to me, John, when I look at the thread that goes through all of your fascinations, it's like you've taken a really good long look at survival and you've sort of asked yourself, well, let's see, if I lived forever, what kinds of things might I have to anticipate to survive?
Well, thank you for that compliment, Mrs. Future. I feel like, in some sense, we are all futurists, whether we know it or not, because we're journeying into the future together. Individuals may or may not make it a certain distance, but hopefully we won't see all of humankind wiped out if we can do something to prevent it.
Yeah, the species will survive. Hey, can you stay for after the break and talk about some other fascinations with us?
I'd be happy to.
Wonderful. Good. Okay. We're listening to the Dr. Future Show. This is Dr. Future himself speaking, and Mrs. Future, and we're talking to John Ferber. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with John Ferber, CEO and founder of Legendary Pharmaceuticals, which we'll focus a little bit more on in this segment. John is an entrepreneur, scientist, who has been very involved with the biology of aging and regeneration for the more than 20 years now. Now, John, I remember one of the first times I was with you almost 30 years ago at UC Santa Cruz, you were fascinated at the time with some amphibians that could regenerate their limbs.
Oh, right? Yes, the axolotls. Axolotls, they are like salamanders. They're a Mexican salamander, actually native to the lake that Mexico City sits over. They have a very robust regenerative ability. If a fish bites off one of their legs, the stump starts to grow a new arm or leg, and eventually, over a period of a couple of weeks, it completely grows out with fingers and toes and everything, and looks just like new.
Wow. Now, what came of your research in this species? Is it something that can be applied to us?
That is not something that we know how to do today. We have found that the small children, in certain cases, when they've accidentally lost a fingertip, will grow a perfectly good fingertip. So we believe that the human genome has the ability to regenerate like this, but it has not been brought into medical knowledge yet. I have some hopes that we can develop regeneration enhancers, ways of turning on our own natural genomic abilities.
So where did your research take you from there? I understand you started looking at the aging process itself.
Yes, there's quite a few now. It wasn't at the time, but now there's quite a few scientists looking at various aspects of aging. So one of the things that I did was to find out what each of them is doing and integrate it into a systems biology of human aging flowchart I've put up on the web for people to refer to, and I'm sure you'll have a link to it on your show notes.
On the Legendary Pharmaceuticals website.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay, I'll make sure there's a link up for that. Now, I've heard, and I think the general public has probably as well, that of programmed cell death and telomeres and that whole arena. Does that area look promising to you as an area of research and focus?
It's one of several things. As far as I know, we can't do just one thing. We need to do several things, and that's a very important one. Telomeres, as probably some of the audience knows, are pieces of DNA at the end of each chromosome. And with cell division, these telomeres get shorter, and as they get shorter, the genes next to them start to either turn on or turn off in an appropriate way.
So the length of the telomere tells you how many more times the cell can divide, essentially, right?
That's part of it. But the other thing is the telomere controls the expression of genes near the telomere. So it's got multiple functions which are just beginning to be understood. In the old days, when the telomeres were first discovered, it was obvious that it would keep frequently dividing cells from dividing forever. But we found that there's also an enzyme in the cell that can extend the telomeres if that enzyme is active. Now, in many of our cells, that enzyme is not active, and there is work going on to find ways to reactivate the telomerase enzyme to extend short telomeres. But the other point I was making is that short telomeres also affect the expression of other genes and can cause the cell to become very sick or die.
Cancerous even, right?
Short telomeres can cause cancer because the cell sees two short telomeres and thinks, oh, this is a broken piece of DNA, and sticks them together when they shouldn't be stuck together. So short telomeres can cause cancer. Short telomeres can cause the cell to malfunction. And in general, we need to do something about both DNA damage in general and short telomeres in particular.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned senolytic drugs. What are senolytic drugs?
Okay, it's a made-up word made up by some very prestigious scientists at the Scripps Institute and the Mayo Clinic. Uh-huh. So we sometimes use the word senescent or senescence to describe aging cells that are no longer functioning well. Maybe they're hair follicle cells that no longer divide, or muscle cells that no longer can grow. And lytic means cutting or breaking or destroying. So senolytic drugs are drugs that will destroy these senescent cells. And as long as you have a way to replace the bad cells with new stem cells, then it's good to get rid of the bad cells. So just this year, a few months ago, Scripps Institute in Florida and Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, published some work that they've been doing for a couple of years, and it made quite a splash because a lot of people hadn't been aware that this was going on. They screened thousands of different existing drugs to see if any of them would kill these senescent cells, and they found two of them. They're drugs that you can already buy today, so it's not one of them.
Approved for other things, I gather.
Yes, that's right. One of them is called quercetin, which is an extract from vegetables that you can buy as a supplement from dietary supplement stores.
Really? Wow.
Online. The other one is harder to get because it's an approved cancer drug, and you would need to what you would need is a doctor's prescription to get a hold of that.
And that's called?
Dasatinib, Dasatinib.
Okay. And those drugs would kill older cells.
And kill older cells that are dysfunctional. Now, you don't want to kill all cells just because they're old, because the oldest cells in your body are your neurons in your brain.
Well, and yeah, you know, those cells were perfectly good when we made them, right?
Right. So the senescent cells are classified as those cells that are supposed to keep dividing that get so old and sluggish that they stop dividing. And then the next thing they do is they start putting out bad hormones called cytokines that start a chain reaction of causing other nearby cells to also become senescent. Hmm. So we want to kill senescent cells, but not all old cells. Some old cells we want to keep, like heart muscle cells, we want to keep.
Now, who's doing the state-of-the-art research in that arena?
Well, in the senolytic drugs, Scripps Institute in Florida and Mayo Clinic, as I say, just published that. In terms of studying senescent cells, Judy Campisi is a researcher who was at Berkeley Labs, just above the University of California, Berkeley, and now she's moved over to the Buck Institute, which is in Marin County in Novato. She's a powerhouse. She's got probably 10 or 15 or more researchers working under her, studying senescent cells, what causes them, how to detect them, and what can be done about them. Mm-hmm. So,
what are the promises of that research, would you say?
Well, first of all, knowing that it's a problem is the first step. These senolytic drugs, this publication that just came out, has caused a great deal of excitement in the field, because prior to that, we didn't have a good way of dealing with these senescent cells. But it's looking like now I think there will be more senolytic drugs discovered in the future, or these two that they found so far can be modified to be even more effective.
Mm, and you combine that with stem cell therapy.
That's exactly them, right? So you want to kill off the dysfunctional cells and then have them replaced by descendants of stem cells.
Mm, very interesting. Now, you also mentioned blood plasma. I've been hearing stories lately about how, if you have the blood of a younger person in your veins, that actually that has an effect on your aging process. Is there any truth to that, or is that a kind of a new age fairy tale?
It's promising based on some work that was done in mice and rats. And in mice and rats, it indeed enhances their brain stem cells, their muscle repair, and their general overall functionality, their coat color, and so forth. When we say coat, we mean like their hair.
Wow. Huh. So do you need blood plasma or full blood from a younger person, or what? How does that work?
Yeah, what's your analysis of what's going on there?
Okay, well, just as a little background, maybe not all of the listeners know what plasma is.
Yeah.
But you might have heard it on a medical TV show. We need a unit of plasma.
No. Right. Or yeah. Used in war situations, that sort of thing. That plasma. Yes. So blood plasma itself from a younger person can. Listen, we have to go to a break. Maybe we can save it to right after the commercial break. Then we can really delve into this a little more deeply.
Sure thing.
Can you hold on a sec, John? Okay. This is KSCO Radio. Listen to the Dr. Future Show. We'll be back right after the break. Welcome back to Dr. Future Show. We're talking to John Ferber of Legendary Pharmaceuticals, currently about blood plasma and how the blood plasma of a younger person can actually rejuvenate an older person.
We're talking about mice and rats, just to be clear. We don't know if it works in people yet, but
we're going to find out pretty soon, because there's already a human experiment going on at Stanford University.
Wow. Okay.
But I just want to backfill a little bit to say that what blood plasma is.
Okay.
If you donate some blood, it looks really red. Now, that red comes from red blood cells. If you spin it in a centrifuge, those red blood cells will go to the bottom, and right above them, you'll see a small layer of white blood cells, which are our immune cells. And above that, you'll see a yellowish clear liquid, and that is the plasma. Mm. So if you are donating whole blood, you can give maybe once every couple months, maybe every 3 months, because you don't want to lose all of your cells. If you're donating plasma, you go to a plasma center, they take out your blood, they spin it in a centrifuge, and then they give you your blood cells back along with some salt water and some other things like that, so that you can actually donate plasma every week.
I see. You can donate every week instead of every few months. I see. That's
right.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, is that as useful for blood transfusions as whole blood?
Well, it turns out in the mouse and rat experiments, it's maybe even better.
Really?
Yeah. It appears, and we're still learning about this, but it appears that old blood has more of certain aging factors in it than young blood, and less of certain youthful factors than young blood. When they did these experiments with mice and rats, they would inject some young blood into an old mouse, and it would grow new brain stem cells. Its muscles would heal faster, and it would be more active and be, in general, youthful.
How often would it have to be infused with the young blood to do that?
Well, you have to be careful extrapolating from mice to people.
Absolutely. But in the mice experiments, what did they find? Was it a continuous thing?
Or? They gave them several injections several days apart, and it was quite interesting and exciting. Now, in the Stanford experiment, I believe they're giving them injections once a week or something like that. And in
That's the human experiments, for those who just tuned
in. So the Stanford human experiments, and their first subjects are volunteers who sign consent forms who have early stage Alzheimer's, and their family members and their caregivers are all on board with this. Because of the mouse experiments and because of an accidental experiment in China, there's reason to believe that it will help reverse Alzheimer's. This accidental experiment in China, an Alzheimer patient had a blood transfusion for another reason, and he got better. This was compelling enough that the relatives, who were a wealthy Chinese family, decided that they wanted to find out what was going on at Stanford, and they contacted the professor there, Tony Weiss Corre, and arranged to invest in starting a biotech company in Palo Alto called Alkahest, which is doing something very similar to the experiments going on the campus. So between this biotech company, Alkahest, and the research on campus at Stanford, we're finally getting experiments done on people. We don't yet have the results. They just started signing up people a couple of months ago. If you happen to have early stage Alzheimer's, or a relative or friend who has early stage Alzheimer's, it's possible to still get in on this study.
Oh, wow.
So. Fascinating. Now, can I just ask some really science questions around this, just for my own curiosity?
Sure. Ms. Streeter, what do you think about plasma itself?
Yeah, about plasma itself. Now, plasma itself is a very specific part of the blood, but when hospitals are giving infusions, do they use other kinds of things for plasma? Do they use salt water? Do they use, I don't know, I thought I heard something about like coconut water being somehow compatible with human blood. And I'm just wondering, are we talking about like a part of the blood that's actually just kind of like liquid and fluid? And, you know, what are the qualities that?
It's a liquid that has some dissolved salts and some dissolved proteins and some dissolved hormones. The major protein component is called albumin. If you're in a situation of grave accident where you've lost a lot of blood volume, indeed, anything you put in will probably help. But in this particular situation, we're looking for plasma from young people because in the young mouse experiments, this improved the health of the old mouse.
Do you have Rh factors with this blood serum? Or,
and what are those?
or is that removed when you centrifuge it?
You certainly have to blood type it because even though you don't have red blood cells to react with your plasma, this plasma, if it's the wrong blood type, will react against your red blood cells. So the blood typing is quite important, but it's very standard. People have been doing transfusions for over 100 years. People have been doing plasma transfusions for 20 years or more. And it's a standard treatment for certain kinds of autoimmune diseases now. People who have antibodies against their own proteins sometimes will have some of their plasma taken out and replaced by plasma from somebody else who's compatible with them in terms of blood type. And that can be ABO typing as well as the Rh typing.
Very interesting. I actually am very interested, is this research You came to the Bay Area this year to go to a particular conference. I know Aubrey de Grey was a big draw. And I'm just wondering, is there anything that you want to report from that conference in the last 5 minutes here?
Yeah, like Aubrey de Grey, for example. He did. I did see him at a TED conference. He did say to say hello to you. So.
Nice.
Yeah. Now, he's been known for doing research in aging as well. I think his approach was he was thinking more about how the cells clean themselves and the self-cleaning mechanisms start to fail as the cells get older, and that he was, at the time at least, he was thinking about that and how to improve the cleaning of the cells.
And I think maybe that's why I was tuning into this, because it seems to me anything involving the plasma is part of the system cleaning itself, since you are talking about the fluids being kind of circulated and flushed, et cetera. And I'm very curious about that part of the process.
Well, good housekeeping is important on several levels. Each individual cell has its own cleaning and recycling and digestive system. And then in between the cells, you've got the blood that has to be purified by the kidneys. And in the brain, there's cerebrospinal fluid that has to be flushed out when we sleep each night. That's one reason why getting a good night's sleep is so important to general health and brain health. And when we sleep at night, the cells surrounding the neurons, called the glial cells, shrink a little bit. This opens up passageways between them, and it helps the brain's cerebrospinal fluid to clear the amyloid beta protein fragments out so that they don't clog up and form plaques in the brain. So the first thing you asked about was the cell cleaning on the inside. And this is something that we're looking at ways to enhance because, well, right now one of the best things you can do is skip a couple of meals a day, at least a couple of days a week. It's called partial day fasting. When the body gets hungry, it upregulates its ability to digest old damaged proteins and old damaged membranes. If you're always eating, the cells say, well, we don't need to recycle anything. We'll just use the new food. So partial day fasting combined with exercise can do quite a bit to enhance the cleaning system.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. That's great.
You mentioned, we only have about a minute left, but if you could say something about brain enhancement drugs and herbs in development. That's what to look for there. That would be really useful.
There's a couple of drugs currently in development. One's called PBT2 from Prana Biotechnology, and it is in human clinical trials for both Huntington's and Alzheimer's disease. And that's developed based on Harvard Medical School research, but the company that is providing it is based in Melbourne, Australia. Another one under development at the Salk Institute, not yet in human trials, but soon to be, is called J147. Both of these drugs improve the health of neurons in the brain. Based on animal studies as well as the early human studies and human volunteers, they both seem to be able to improve the ability to have good short-term and long-term memory and to make decisions quickly and accurately. In terms of herbs, turmeric, the yellow spice that some people use to make curry,
yes,
is very good for neurons. And structurally, the shape of the molecule is somewhat similar to PBT2 and J147. These are all double ring structures. There's also a number of colored fruits and vegetables. Almost anything that has some color, that color is due to multi-ringed structures.
Like blueberries.
Yes, apples. Blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, grapes, carrots, all sorts of deeply colored fruits and vegetables. There's an excellent book by Jim Joseph called The Color Code that has a couple of pages on each of these colored fruits and vegetables.
Okay, we got to go now. Thank you, John. And legendarypharma.com, is that the best place to find out more about your...
Yeah, make sure you spell pharma with a P-H. L-E-G-E-N-D-A-R-Y-P-H-A-R-M-A.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, John, for being on the Dr. Future Show. Appreciate your attention, and we look forward to seeing you in the near future.
My pleasure.
All right. Now have a good day.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Dr. Future Show on KSEO. Thanks for listening.